From the Professional Disc Golf Association, this is PDGA Radio News.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of PDGA Radio. I'm Steve Hill, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Sarah Lamberson. Sarah, did you have a nice weekend?
I did. It was pretty low-key. It was raining around here, but I got an early morning round in yesterday, and it was pretty nice. What about you?
That's all you can ask for. I did. I went and watched around. I went out to the Daniel Bowe Memorial out here in Escondido. There's an A tier, so I'll talk about that a little bit more later. And then, yeah, nothing else too big besides that. Did some yard work. Real exciting domestic stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Had to be done, though. Like, the weeds are getting out in the weeds here in Southern California these days, so.
Yep, it's mowing season around here, too, so.
Oh, yeah.
I'm with you. Yeah.
All right, so we got a little bit of more of an abbreviated show this week with there not being a big pro event, but Sarah, what do we have in line for this week?
So this week we're going to talk about the three A-tiers that just happened this past weekend. We're going to have a short rules break with Robert Leonard, who is the TD of Am Worlds this year, and then we're going to round it out with an interview with Justin Menichelli, who is the PDGA board president.
Yeah, I'm excited to have him come on the show. Always good to, you know, get some of the people behind the PDGA. I want to do that a little bit more this year. So, first though, let's start it off. I mean, three A-tiers this weekend. We're going to start out east and move west. So the first event that we are going to look at was the Throw Down the Mountain. I believe it was Throw Down the Mountain 5. Was it number 5?
I think it was 7.
No. Did I miss that many throws? Oh, it was 6. We split
6.
The difference.
All right, there we go.
Good try, us. Good averaging out on math. All right, so this is the Throw Down the Mountain presented by Sun King out in Brooksville, Florida. And this is, we talked about this one last week as the This Week in History segment where Austin Turner won it as his first and only A-tier back in 2016. Unfortunately, our boy Austin did not win this week. He came in 4th place because Paul Macbeth took this one start to finish. It wasn't even really close. He got his first win of the season with a 32 under par 151. Took home $1,200. And he shot all 3 rounds above his already very high 1050 rating. So honestly, not really surprised to see him put it together after the performance he had out in Waco, where he got things back together with the putter, struggled a little bit, but you know, I think he won this one last year as well, so this seems to be a place that he's comfortable at. He was talking about on Twitter how if they made a couple changes, this would be like one of his top 5 courses. So congrats to Paul Macbeth for getting his first win of the season. Weird that it's March, whatever, almost April, and we're talking about Paul Macbeth's first win of the season. Does that feel weird to you?
Yeah. A little bit, but it's also exciting. I think we touched on this last week that there's new names up on the leaderboard. Just gives us more people to talk about and more people to watch on coverage.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah. Speaking of coverage, you talked to Terry Miller. He is going to have coverage of this one coming out, right?
Yeah, so he was there all weekend. He filmed. It was just him. I think he got a volunteer to do the catch cam on the basket side. But he filmed 3 full rounds of MPO, and then he said he got a lot of footage of the women, so he's going to put together a highlight reel.
Cool.
So, yeah, looking forward to seeing that.
You know, I didn't take the time. I think there's footage out there of the last couple years of this event. I personally haven't taken the time to watch it, but I'm excited to see it. It's from what I hear, it's obviously, I mean, it's Throw Down the Mountain, it's Florida. You think Florida and you think flat. So nice to see some elevation changes in Florida, and I'm excited for that coverage to come out. Rounding out the rest of the top 5, we had Matt Orem taking 2nd place, Calvin Heimberg in 3rd, Austin Turner and Jamie Mosier in 4th. And you know what? We'll go down to the top 10 because we're doing it. Charlie Goodpasture and Cam Kogelazer tied for 6th. Nick Masters, another Florida kid, and David Eilers in 8th. And then Matt Dollar and Benjamin Stemmen. I apologize, Benjamin, if I'm pronouncing your last name wrong. Tied for 10th place. So pretty good field here. 49 open players. And then, you know, let's talk about real quick what happened on the women's side before we wrap up this tournament with a couple other little bits of news. So what do we have over on the open women's side?
Yeah. So it was pretty close, on the women's side. Madison Walker and Elaine King ended up tying after 3 rounds, and Madison took it in a sudden death playoff. And they ended up +5, Courtney McCoy, shot +7, tied with Ellen Widboom, and Hannah Leatherman rounded out the top five with +9. So I got to watch a couple of the little tidbits here and there that I think Terry and some other people posted on social media. And I guess that course has several backup. So there are some fun videos of Elaine doing cartwheels. And I watched that over and over again because I thought it was, did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay. It's great. It's like perfect form.
Wow.
She basically taught a lesson on cartwheels. So
I feel like it's kind of a dying art form. Like my 7-year-old doesn't know how to do a cartwheel.
Oh, that's sad. Well, no, I'm not, you should get Elaine to teach her.
I'll hurt myself. Yeah, maybe I will. Maybe I'll get Elaine. I'll call her in. We need to have definitely. Elaine on the show. Elaine is great. I mean, she's essentially on the PDGA board now. And gosh, can we just comment on the fact that she is still just so, so good?
Yeah, she's killing it. And I mean, I just looking at some of the men's results over the past couple months, there, other than Johnny McRae, there are no men that can play Masters that are like ending up in first, second, third, you know, maybe even in the top five. So yeah, she kills it.
Yeah. And just, you know, I've had nothing but good interactions with her over the last couple of years. She's probably one of the more like, not to say that people aren't intelligent, but she's super intelligent. And so you get some really good conversations with her beyond just disc golf.
Yeah. And she's very analytical about life, but also disc golf, the way that she kind of picks apart her game. And I don't know if you like her, Elaine King disc golfer Facebook page.
Yeah. Yeah.
But some of the things that she posts on there are just, really intuitive and interesting to read. So yeah, she's great for the sport. Glad that she's on the board, and I think we should definitely have her on the show.
And still out. I just love that she's still out playing. I mean, she's in her 50s now, and she's still going out to plenty of events. I mean, she's not hitting the full tour, but I wouldn't expect her to. But if it's an A tier on the East Coast, it's pretty certain that she's playing it. So
for sure. And she's one of those people that kind of benefits from the fact that the PDGA went from an all inclusive professional world championship. Just FPO, MPO, and then a separate Masters World Championships, because she's one of those people that can go to both and potentially get in the top five or top 10 in FPO, but then also go and win a World Championship title for herself in the Masters Worlds. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah, where did she? Amazing. I'm trying to remember where exactly she ended up last year at Pro Worlds. She was on, I don't know if she was on lead card for a while, but I mean, she was right up there at least for a little bit.
Yeah. And she's one of those people that she does not throw as far as Paige or Kat, but she plays boring golf. She is so consistent and rarely misses. Yeah, she just rarely misses the fairway.
She came in 10th at Pro Worlds last year.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Gosh, we should turn this into the Elaine King show today. I'm sorry. We're kind of probably going on, but I'm sure that anyone who is listening to this program probably doesn't mind that we are spending plenty of time on, you know, the most winning disc golfer ever. So
yeah, I'd hope not. And then just a note about Hannah Leatherman. She was coming back from a wrist injury last year. So I think she played one other event so far this year, but this was her first big event. So it was good to see her back on the tour and ending up fifth. So,
and she was in, I believe she was up near the lead after the first day or two.
Yeah, she shot the hot round, second round.
Yeah.
So that put her in a pretty good position, and had a little bit rough round, third round. But she still cashed, so pretty That's good start to her season. For. Yeah.
Moving back over real quick to the men's side before we move on to our next event. Zach Melton was out of this tournament. He came in 12th. He tied for 12th place. And then he posted on Facebook that he was actually in a car accident on the way home. He's fine, thankfully, but it sounds like his car is not. So, you know, send some good vibes towards Zach Melton's way. He's one of the good guys. Plus, he's a fellow lefty, so I have to throw him some love. And he's got great hair and beard. He's just like, you know who Zach Melton is? Zach Melton reminds me of, like, the disc golf version of Bob Ross a little bit.
Yeah, I could see that.
In both hair and just demeanor. Like, he's just really Like, he's just a really positive, uplifting kind of guy. So, hate to see that happen to him, but hopefully he'll be back on the road soon. Glad that he is safe.
Yes.
But just, you know, that's one of those risks with everyone out being out on the road all the time. I mean, there's so many miles being logged. I'm glad we don't hear about that stuff more. So,
yeah.
Let's move toward the Midwest, where quite a few players just stayed in Texas. You know, we had Waco last week, and with this event this week, the Open at Flat Creek, a lot of people just decided to stay in the area. I believe it was in outside of Austin, so not too far to go. South by Southwest was in town, too, so you could have people going there and seeing some concerts and hanging out and playing some disc golf. And speaking of playing some disc golf, holy cow, James Conrad. James Conrad shot a 17 under par final round to come from the chase card and win by 3 strokes.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, it's like, it was a 10, it was 1072 rated. Okay, so yeah, this is a par 64 layout. He shot a 47 final round. He shot a 49 the second round. I believe I saw Bradley Williams on Facebook mention that those were both back-to-back course records. So congratulations to James Conrad for playing some incredibly hot golf. And double congratulations for the fact that his first round came in at 999. So he went from shooting under 1,000 to 1056 to 1072 and winning $1,400 in the process with just a, I mean, a 17 under par round. I don't know that there's anyone out there for video, which is a bummer because
I was just going to ask that.
I don't know of it. I'll look into it and report back next week, but I haven't heard of anyone being there. But that's,
and it wasn't like this was
a lot of birdies.
Yeah. And it wasn't like this was just a light division. He had Wysocki, Joel
no,
Freeman, Bradley 61, Williams.
Yeah. 61,
yeah.
Open division.
Yeah. Jeremy Colling. Yeah. I'm just looking down the list.
Oh, yeah. I mean, quite a few of the top men's players from last week stayed there,
yeah.
Which makes sense. And I mean, that's a smart move on, you know, Neil Dambra, the TD's part. Just to know that, hey, Waco's going to be in town. Let's get all these guys to stay, and they don't have to go far. It's super smart. Also, shout out to John Perry. He's 995 rated from Michigan. Actually, I watched him play a bit at Worlds last year. He was on, I believe, the first round card that I followed with Paul McBeth and Martin Hendel and Peter McBride. So got to see him play a little bit last year, but he came in second place, shot all three rounds like 40 points above his rating. Almost. So, great performance from him. Ricky Wysocki came in third place, tied for third. He actually led after the first round and then shot a 976 rated second round. I didn't go back past last year, but that is the lowest round he has shot in the last year, at least. I don't know the last time he went that far under 1,000, like just by going into the ratings detail page. I'd not see anything else, you know. This is one of those situations, I don't know what happened. I didn't see it. I don't want to speculate. I didn't want to call up Ricky and be like, hey, dude, what's going on? but, you know, he struggled a little bit early this season by the standard that he's set for himself. I know we talked a little bit off the air last week. I sent you some of his stats for the first three events. For the first three events, comparing them to last year, you thought maybe it wasn't terribly fair to compare the first three events to the whole season, which is totally fine. But on the whole, he just seems to be a little off, so hopefully he can get it back on track. I was thinking about it today. I wouldn't be surprised, like the way last season started with a major in January and Worlds was in June, so I'm just wondering if Ricky was just so mentally locked in early that maybe this year he's, because there isn't a major and Worlds is later this year, I'm wondering if he's just not as mentally locked in yet as he needs to be.
Yeah, just kind of like lost the edge.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It's hard to keep that edge for that long. And, you know, I would imagine he's probably getting to the point in his career where he's similar to McBeth, where obviously these guys want to win the NTs and A-tiers, but the big ones are the majors. And, you know, at some point you try and, I'm sure he tries to get it up for everything, but there's just a different level of focus, I think, at those events. So, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe it's all nothing, and maybe he's just having a rough go of it with accuracy or putting or something, but suffice to say, I don't expect to see Ricky Wysocki, you know, continue to come in third at all these events. I'm sure he's going to notch a win pretty soon. Also on the leaderboard, Joel Freeman tied for third place with Bradley Williams and Landon Knight. Happy to see Joel back up there. He was up in the mix after the first couple rounds of Waco, too, before dropping down a little bit. But really cool to see that the Las Vegas performance by him wasn't just like a random fluke, you know? Like, he's showing it week in and week out that he can be competing.
Yeah, I love that. It was kind of how Eagle was. He was just on the spot all of a sudden and never dropped off, and now everyone knows his name. So I hope it continues to be like that for Joel.
Yeah, same here. Couple other guys, you know, young guys up in the top 10, Kevin Jones, Drew Gibson. So really strong field at that event. And same thing on the women's side, right?
So Kat squeaked by with the win at four down. She didn't shoot any rounds over her rating, but I believe she is the third or fourth highest rated female in the world right now. So her rating's pretty high. She doesn't always have to shoot over her rating.
Right.
Yeah. And then Hokum took second, just one back of Katrina at three down. She had a pretty low rated round. The second round, she shot 887, which is pretty surprising for her. But she brought it back third round, shooting a 60, 956 rated, and got her back in the mix. And then someone that I was, that's, you know, on the top of mind just from previous events is Rebecca Cox. She was in what tied for second after the first round. And then she was in solo first after the second round, the only female under par at that point.
Awesome.
Yeah. And she ended one down in solo third. So super proud of her. She's a young player. I believe this is her first year full-time touring.
Yeah, she toured a little bit last year, kind of off and on.
Yeah, yeah. So that's just great. I mean, I think last event we saw that she started off really kind of hit or miss and then brought it back a little bit later. But she started off strong and ended strong. And she shot average 36 points above her rating overall. So I'm pretty sure her rating is going to shoot up over 900 right now. She's 897.
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, only up for her to be going right now. So last couple weeks really strong. I'm excited to see what the rest of the season brings for her. I mean, it's, you know, we've kind of talked about it with Kona Panis a little bit, who we'll talk about in a minute out west, but just the more young women's players we can get out at these events up in the mix, I love it. It only good can come of that, in my opinion.
Yep, for sure. And then to round out the top five, Jessica Weiss came in fourth, shooting plus two. She shot pretty strongly, only one round around her player rating. Her last round was pretty low, but she's still up in the mix there. And then Danielle Vargas, I was happy to see. She ended solo fifth, and she didn't play any events. She's from Texas, didn't play any events in 2017, so I'm really happy to see her back on the board.
Yeah, not bad. Did not play at all last year, and Bebo come in top five.
Yeah. And it was a pretty hefty women's division too. There are 14 that showed up, including the Mondawano sisters.
Oh yeah.
Always cool to see them out battling back and forth, and they actually tied. So
that's awesome.
I wonder how that dinner conversation went.
A lot of rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I don't know. I would imagine at this point mom and dad are pretty well versed at settling those kind of things.
Yeah, I would think.
So. Nice. Yeah. And then heading out west, we had the event that I went to, the Daniel Bowe Memorial. I didn't head out for the women's round because they had them very early in the morning. It was like 7:30 on Sunday. I was doing some family stuff, but I did get out there on Friday and just said hi to Lisa and Lisa Fakus and Melody Weibel and a couple other people. And really nice event. Basically, It's kind of fun to go to this event for me, because it's essentially my home course. This is the I kind of split my home course between two different tracks, and this is one of them. So it's just kind of cool to go to an event at a course that you play. And granted, this is a different layout than I normally play. They extended a little bit, but man, just to see people so much better than you make it look so much easier it's highly entertaining and incredibly humbling. So really cool event. Mark Verrocki, the TD, is great. He puts on this event every year. If you don't know Mark, you may actually know of him. He is the guy who dives in the pond at Maple Hill every year to get people.
Yeah.
So he has a little bit of fame already from that. He lives out here now and puts on this event, and it was a great time. I took my daughter out to watch yesterday, and she kind of had fun. She stuck with it. She's only seven, so she could she had moments where she wasn't super into it, but I think when I was seven and my dad was dragging me out to the disc golf course, I was probably whining about it. So, you know, she'll get there. But anyway, let's talk about the FPO side a little bit first, and then I'll give some more observations from following the lead card men's. So, Sarah, what do we got over on FPO for this event?
So, a little bit smaller field. Guess got the win by one stroke over Leslie Todd. She shot near her rating. Leslie Todd shot over her rating every round. So it looks like they had a battle. And then Kona, who we just mentioned, finished third. I don't know. I would have liked to see. I think it's going to be interesting seeing Kona and Rebecca Cox battle it out. They're the two young touring players. They both just have so much skill and ability, and I'm interested to see how they shoot it out.
I believe Kona told me she's heading out for GBO.
Okay.
Oh, and actually, she's playing Jonesboro too. So we'll get to see them go up against each other at a couple events pretty soon, cool. Which is cool. They might be in that mini battle category that we like to bring up.
I hope so.
Their ratings are 1 point apart right now.
Love it.
Kona's awesome. Kona's up one. She's at 898. Anyway, back to the action there. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. So she's continuing, obviously, to have a very strong beginning to her season. And then after the top three, Lisa shot even, Leslie plus one, Kona plus six. And then there was 13 strokes between third and fourth. Christy Moore took fourth, and Melody Weibel had kind of a rough go of it. Her first round was 786.
She had a very rough go of it, yeah.
Yeah, luckily that'll drop off her rating. It's like 140 points. I don't even begin to understand the rating system, but it's something about standard deviations. And
yeah,
whatnot,
right.
So.
If you get too low, you get... I was trying to think about it because I went into... Like, I saw her before this round. She seemed like in a really good mindset. She seemed super chill. It wasn't terribly windy that day. It was a little bit, but not too bad. The only thing I can think of is maybe the wind kicked up a little more, and then they did have the OBs tightened up pretty well at this course. So I'm wondering if the OBs got her. That's the only thing I could figure. I didn't get a chance to see her yesterday to ask, but that'd be my guess. And she rebounded really well the rest of the tournament.
Yeah. Her second round was lower than her player rating as well, but she shot a really good third round, which put her in fifth. Unfortunately, she didn't cash. They only paid out three, but hopefully that doesn't happen again. I'm sure she'll rebound from that, in the season and move on like we all do.
Yeah.
But, so what happened on the men's side?
Man, the men's side was really exciting. Going into the final, there was a three-way tie at the top between Seppo Paiu, Bobby Music, and Sias Elmore. Sias has actually been out touring a little bit more this year. He's from Northern California, sponsored by DGA. He's only rated 996, but I fully expect that number to go up, especially with the performance he put in here this week. But not the most imposing guy in terms of distance, but really excellent control, really strong putting, strong mental game. So that was fun to see him up there. But so, yeah, going into the final round, it was three-way tie for first, and then Paul Ulibarri was one shot back. Spoiler alert, Paul ended up winning. The final round was actually really cool. I don't want to go like too hole by hole, because if you weren't there, obviously it could get a little, you get in the weeds a little bit, but suffice to say, just to kind of start things off, Paul hit a nice putt on the first hole to take a birdie. Seppo had a kind of a weird OB. It was like the wind just kind of kept his disc straight, and he threw something pretty overstable. And so that caused him to take an early bogey OB, but you know, he bounced back really well. Him and Paul both made just some crazy long drives. They basically took two holes and combined them into one on a different section of the course for hole number seven. And it's this kind of, it's only a, I think it's only 420 feet, but they listed it as a par four because there was OB on the left, really low canopy, not much of a line, and they both just peered it and put it to within like 40 feet and both hit for eagles there. So that was pretty exciting.
Wow.
And just, yeah, a couple big moments like that. You know, Seppo hit a 60-foot putt for eagle on the 11th hole, which was another par four. This one's, I'd say it's about 500 feet, but it's another one where there's we have a lot of pepper trees around here. And so for people who don't know pepper trees, they're very low dangling canopy. And like, they're not strong trees in terms of like, they're not going to eat up your disc like an oak tree or whatever, but they'll stop your shot. And so a lot of people on this hole throw a roller. Seppo threw this roller that I swear went 400 feet in the air first before even touching down, and then rolled and landed in a creek, but the creek was playing inbounds. It's usually dry. It was a little wet this time of year. And then he just canned the 60-footer. It was super exciting. But then a couple holes later, he missed like a super easy putt. Really kind of hit the skids a little bit in the middle of the round, and so he lost his momentum. And kind of the whole time, Paul Ulibarri was just kind of trucking along. You know, he had had a nasty spit out early, hit another tree, and took an unfortunate par, which this course, it's kind of deuce or die at this tournament. And so he's plugging along, and it seemed like Seppo was having a lot of the momentum, and he's making these great shots and huge putts, and then the wheels kind of came off for him, and Paul put it down. I think he birdied six out of the last nine. He birdied like six in a row on the back nine and then parred out because he was playing safe and was able to, and took the win by one. So it was a really
exciting
cool event. Yeah, it was. It was fun. It's kind of hard to translate all of it if you weren't there. So I apologize to anyone who's listening and are thinking, wow, sounds kind of mundane. But Paul, the thing that I really liked watching was just seeing how Paul bounced back. Like, I talked to him a little bit. There was a backup after hole 10, and he had just this nasty, nasty spit out. Like, hit dead center, and it flopped out. And it was just like, they're putting on like DGA Mach 3s or something. You know, it's an older course. We only have the one A tier here a year, so they're not pumping in like any of the high-end newfangled baskets or anything. But yeah. So that was unfortunate, and he was getting down on himself a little bit, because the hole before that, he had thrown a really nice shot and hit a tree, and it rolled into a creek. So he was kind of hitting the skids a little bit and was getting down on himself a little bit. And then he recovered. You know, it was almost like the backup did him a little good, I think. He recovered from that, had enough time to cool off, and showed some resiliency, which was great. So congratulations to him for the win. That's actually his fourth win this season already. Second at an A tier. That guy just plays all the dang time. What else from the event? You know, Bobby Music had a 988 final round, which was kind of a bummer after he went 1055 for the second round. Really, the biggest thing was him was just putting. He was a little bit shorter than everyone else distance-wise, and so his putts were a little bit longer, and they just weren't falling. Max Nichols climbed up into fourth place from the chase card, so that was great. All in all, just a fun event. And, you know, nice to go out and see some people kind of tear up the local course. So, good event on the whole.
Cool.
So, since we've been talking about people's round ratings and everything, let's take a second and look at the hot rounds for this weekend. So, Sarah, you've got our hot rounds in the FPO. What happened? It wasn't all just at the events that we talked about, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, one that wasn't one of the events that we talked about was the hottest female round, and not necessarily FPO. This one came in for the female amateur division at Throw Down the Mountain, and that was Deanne Donaldson. I've played with her several times. She's from Rock Hill, South Carolina. She's rated 864. I guess I should tell you what her round rating was. It was 977.
Wow.
Which is insane. I would say it's time to move up, but I think she's I think she's probably preparing for Am Worlds in Charlotte, just very close by to where she lives. So Yeah, she won the Am side of Throwdown the Mountain this weekend by 17 strokes.
It's a lot.
She shot 10 down over, it was a B tier for the Am side, so just two rounds. So she shot 10 down for the two rounds. So extremely impressive. Congrats to her. And then one event that we did not talk about was the 2018 DLHO driven by Innovadiscs and delivered by Twisted Flyer. B tier. That's a mouthful.
Some of these tournament names, we might have to have an episode devoted to tournament names. Some of the tournament names are getting
long.
Just wait till we talk about Nick Hyde in a couple weeks.
You got to throw those sponsors in there whenever you
can. No, it's great. It's great. It's a good problem to have. It's a good problem to have. You just got to take a couple extra breaths before you say the tournament name.
Yeah. So at that event that I won't say again, Jennifer Allen shot just one rating point below what Deanne shot with a 976. Not surprised to see her name on the board. She crushes, clearly. And then the next two were at the Open at Flat Creek, Sarah Hokum with the 974 and Rebecca Cox with the 965. And then the last was third on the mountain again, Elaine King shooting a 958.
Like
so,
you said, she's very good.
She is very good at disc golf.
Breaking news here on PDGA Radio. Elaine King, good at disc golf.
You heard it here first.
Oh, yes. Man. This is, take that, other podcasts. All right, on the men's side, we talked about James Conrad and his crazy 1072 rated final round. That was the hottest round of the weekend for the Open at Flat Creek for his victory. Paul McBeth and his win out in Florida shot a 1066 rated round. I believe that was his first round. And then let's see here. Here's the other bummer kind of part. Ricky Wysocki, who he shot that, we talked about, he shot like a 976 rated round. His first round was actually the third hottest round of the weekend at 1065. So he was up there. Paul Ulibarri's final round, 1056 out at the Daniel Bow, and then Bobby Music's second round, 1055, also at the Daniel Bow Memorial, rounds out our top five. And then got to give a shout out to Jake Nye out of the Pro Masters 40 Plus division, playing at the Nuga 2018 out in Chattanooga. Looks like it was just a one-day C-tier, two rounds, one day. He won the Pro Masters 40-plus division by opening up play with a 1051 rated 44. So
nice.
Congrats to Jake Nye. He was not necessarily, he definitely would have cracked the top 10 if we went all the way to open. He wasn't in the top five, but always like to give a shout-out to those players who maybe we haven't heard of cracking some good scores. So we got one in each division this week. That's good.
Yeah.
All right. So I think now we are going to take a little break. When we come back, we are going to hear from Robert Leonard. He's going to take some time and break down kind of a, there's an interesting rules scenario, which we missed on last week's show. Honestly, Sarah, I didn't even realize it was a big thing. I must have missed this during the coverage last week. But there was a situation at the Waco where Jeremy Colling kind of altered his line of play, and there was some debate about if he should have, more or less. So Robert's going to break that down for us, and then I'm going to talk to PDGA Board President Justin Menichelli, and we'll wrap up the show after that. So we'll be back here in just a minute on PDGA Radio.
Hi, this is Robert Leonard, PDGA Marshal and Tournament Director for the 2018 PDGA Amateur World Disc Golf Championships driven by Innova, and this is your PDGA Radio Rules Break. This week, we're talking about Rule 804.02, Prohibited Routes, and the point of this rule is to clarify what a mandatory line is and then what should happen if you've not passed the mandatory line. Now, before we get into this, it is important to understand the difference between a mandatory and a mandatory line. The mandatory is the object that you pass around. The mandatory line is on the incorrect side of that mandatory that dignifies when you have actually missed that mandatory. And where this really comes into play, where people don't realize, is in regards to footing and how you should affect that footing in regards to the line of play to the mandatory. And we actually saw this happen on the PDGA Tour recently at the Waco Annual Charity Open presented by Dynamic Discs. So what happened was on hole 18, Jeremy Colling had thrown a great tee shot and was short of a mandatory that was off to the right of the fairway that was there to prohibit players from throwing out over a walking path. And the group agreed with the consensus that Jeremy, since he had not passed this mandatory, should line up directly with that mandatory as opposed to the basket. And as 804.02 points out, that ruling that the group made was incorrect. The easiest way to really understand what is a admittedly confusing rule is anytime you're short of a mandatory, you should ask yourself two questions. Am I short of the mandatory? And am I on the incorrect side of the mandatory? So if you are short of a mandatory and on the incorrect side of that mandatory, then you should line up directly with that mandatory for your line of play. And that's where that mandatory line comes in. In the situation that we saw in Waco, Jeremy was short of the mandatory, but because he had thrown such a great drive, he was on the correct side of that mandatory. Therefore, he did not accomplish those two things that are needed to change your line of play to the mandatory. So whenever you're out on the course and you are faced with that situation of a mandatory and the basket and you're not sure which one's your line of play, just ask yourself those two questions. Am I short of the mandatory and am I on the incorrect side of the mandatory? And if you're short and on the incorrect side, your line of play is to that mandatory. Otherwise, take that line right to that basket. Once again, this is Robert Leonard with the PDGA Radio Rules Break, and reminding you, as always, rules are your friend.
Joining us now on PDGA Radio, we have PDGA Board President Justin Menichelli. Justin, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
Thanks, Steve. I'm awesome. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Now, in addition to being president of the PDGA Board of Directors, Justin also co-wrote the book, The Definitive Guide to Disc Golf, and in his day-to-day life is a professor at Western Carolina University. And that's kind of where I want to start today, Justin. You know, I think a lot of times when it comes to PDGA dealings and the board and everything, like, you know, a lot of what the board does is kind of in the background. People maybe don't get a sense of actually who's behind some of the decisions or things like that. So tell me a little bit more about just your day-to-day when you're not doing PDGA board member stuff.
Well, like you said, I'm a professor at Western Carolina University, and I teach motor behavior mostly, which is basically how people learn motor skills, how children learn motor skills, or how people may relearn motor skills after an accident.
Oh, okay.
And so I'd say about half of my students are recreational therapy students, that many of whom want to go to PT school, physical therapy school. And then the other half are physical education students.
Now, how did you come across that? Like, do you have a physical therapy background or anything like that? Or was this from a more of a kinesiology standpoint yourself?
Yeah, no, I have an undergrad degree in exercise science. And so that's really where my interest lies, is in that type of stuff. Motor behavior, biomechanics, things of that nature.
Okay. And now I believe you have taught disc golf there too at some point, correct?
I do teach disc golf, man, every fall. It's just been great. It's 2 credit hours. It counts for absolutely nothing other than credit hours. And, you know, it doesn't count as in any major program. We do not have a PE requirement at this university.
Sure.
So it's just for credit hours, and it fills in just about 24 hours, the class.
No kidding.
Up. Yeah.
How many students are in that class?
I cap it at 25, and then some students, you know, beg their way in. So, you know, 28, 29, 30.
Okay. So, like, what's the expectation with that class? Like, are you getting people who already know disc golf? Are you getting people who have never touched a disc before and you're providing them equipment? Like, how does that work?
Oh, I get very few folks that have ever played before.
Wow.
Very few. Maybe one or two a semester.
Okay.
All newbies, just about.
I mean, so do you have like a set of discs that you hook them up with and everything like that?
Well, they're required to bring at least a single disc to class.
All right, they got to buy books for other classes, right? So that makes sense.
They have to buy a book for this one too, man. You know which one it is.
I'm sure. That's a good opportunity. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, that was the reason initial reason I wrote it. There wasn't a textbook available, but yeah, they could check out discs for free at the university. You know, at the where you check out a tennis racket or a. Or you know, anything else, basketball. Yeah. So they do that, most of them.
And there's a course right there on campus, or do you have to go off campus?
Yeah, no, we got a course that I designed with the help of Chris Teuton in 2005, and it's right here on campus.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, the putting basket's like a putter throw away from the back door of my building.
So you better be a really good putter.
By design. My putting's improving.
There you go. That's all you could ask for, right?
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the book then. I mean, how, you know, it's been out for a while now. For people who haven't seen it or read it, it's called The Definitive Guide to Disc Golf. You can't miss it. It's got a big PDGA logo on the front and Paul McBeth throwing a forehand. You're one of the co-authors of it. Now, how are you able to integrate that into the class and, you know, more broadly, you know, how's the response been? We're a little under 2 years out from the release of the book, right?
Yeah, it came out April 2016.
Okay, so yeah, just under 2 years. So I mean, how's the response been in that 2 years, and how do you integrate that into the class?
Well, the response has been fantastic, really, really great. It's selling well. The reviews have been outstanding. I mean, just I could not be more pleased with the reviews, for sure. And you know, integrates well into my class because I started writing a textbook for my disc golf class. So, you know, if you take tennis or basketball or some other PE elective at a university, you know, there's always a textbook, not maybe the size of your physics textbook, but it's a paperback textbook for the class to deliver the cognitive information. And so I started writing what was going to be a disc golf textbook. And it just so happens, Ryan Pickens, shout out to Ryan Pickens, my co-author, who's a great guy and a great player. He is in we're in the Asheville Club together, Western North Carolina Disc Golf Club out of Asheville together. And he was writing a book too. And strangely enough, and he was, I was a little further along with the writing, but he was a little further along with basically everything else. He had an indie press that was maybe interested in the project, and you know, he had done a lot of the legwork, and I hadn't done really any legwork. And so we met over a few pints and decided that we would co-author together. And so, you know, that was probably, I don't know, 8 years ago when we first met.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it, you know, it took us a while. You know, the book was, we had, I think, four publishing offers by the end of it all. And Triumph Books out of Chicago came in at the last minute and offered us a publishing agreement. And we decided to go with Triumph Books, and it's just taken off since then. So it's been great.
Now, are there any like revisions or are you guys working on a follow-up or anything like that? Or... is it just kind of staying as it is for now?
Oh, there's a lot of revisions. You know, I've befriended, of course, Elaine King, who's on the board, and then her husband, Eric. And Eric read the book, and he's real into disc golf history and things. So he sent me a bunch of revisions. Suggestions kind of thing.
Sure.
And I think that was a big help. So, you know, we're hoping to do a a second edition. They have done a second printing, but we're hoping to do a second edition and incorporate some of those revisions. We'll have to see what the publisher, you know, agrees to. So
right. Very nice. Now, before I move on more to your role with the board of directors, I do want to ask one more thing about your job at Western Carolina. And it wasn't in the context for this interview. It was for something else. I don't recall what, but I happened across your profile on ratemyprofessors.com. And it sounds the general consensus is that you are fair, but a pretty tough grader. Do you think that's a reasonable assessment?
That is a fair assessment, I think. I mean, other than maybe my disc golf class, I think I'm a pretty easy grader. But in my motor behavior course, which is it's kind of a gateway course, it's a prereq for physical therapy school. And so I think that's pretty fair. That's a fair assessment.
All right. Very nice. Very nice. So moving into, you know, your role with the board, this is your first go round as president. You know, what do you see as your, I don't know, I guess, what do you see as your ultimate responsibility? I mean, there are a lot of different goals and ideals for the PDGA. What do you see as your ultimate goal as president of the board?
Well, you know, during my first summit, during the fall summit, it was my first summit as president, not my first summit, but my first as president, I passed out a graph, a membership graph by year. And there were two lines. One was active men and boys, and the other was active women and boys. And I passed that around very first thing of my first summit. And the message was, you know, let's not get too full of ourselves. We're growing at a tremendous rate. I think a sustainable rate, but a tremendous rate. But, you know, we're still just a hair over 7% women and girls. And I think if it's going to be sustainable growth over the long haul, I think we need to use this data to, you know, when we make any kind of decision, we need to refer to this data. We need to use this data to inform all of our decision making and say, okay, this is great. This is a great initiative. But how does this impact how we can grow the sport for women and girls?
And that's, I mean, that's kind of the, there's been a lot of discussion. I mean, there's always discussion about that, but even more so recently with, you know, more of a focus on the professional tours and everything like that. But even at just a membership level, you know, what are your thoughts on how we get more women to participate and maybe not even become PDGA members, but just literally get out and participate? How do we, what are your thoughts on how we make it more attractive to women and girls to play?
Well, we need to I think it's education is one piece, one critical piece. You know, if you imagine a pyramid, and at the base, if you build a wide base at the pyramid, then there's more room at the top. And so I think it starts with the base. And I think building a wide base means going out and educating physical education teachers to turn on kids to disc golf. Because PE teachers are different, man. I mean, they're different than, say, a kindergarten teacher or a fifth grade language arts teacher. And that's because, you know, at a, say you got an elementary school with 300 students. Well, typically you might have two PE teachers there that teach all the kids.
Exactly.
Much different than the kindergarten teacher that teaches a small portion, or at least a portion of the kindergarten class, or a fifth grade language arts teacher that teaches a small portion of the kids. And so if you can educate PE teachers about disc golf and how great it is. And believe me, PE teachers love disc golf. If we can do that, then we'll get more kids playing and we'll get more girls playing, and girls grow up to be women. And I think that's, so I think that's critical. And we've definitely at the PDGA, we've focused our efforts for sure. In fact, I just got back from Nashville, Tennessee, where I was at the, used to be called AFERD. Now it's called SHAPE. It's basically
I was going to ask you about that, right? Yeah. You and Joe Chargaloff, the executive director, were both out there, correct?
We were. It's the National PE Health and Physical Education Teacher Conference, basically. That's what it is.
And what was the response like just in general to disc golf out there?
Oh, it's always phenomenal. It's always phenomenal. You know, we met up with the Edge team out there, Educational Disc Golf Experience. We met up with their team, which, you know, they're great. And it's just always tremendous. And we could double our efforts in this area and still not reach everybody. But PE teachers just, they loved us. They loved Jay and Des Redding. You know, I don't know if you're friends with Jay and Des, but, you know, they're fantastic people, and they're great practitioners and great demonstrators. And I mean, just, it's just, the response is just always incredible. So
what are the, I guess my follow-up question that then is what are the challenges of getting disc golf into more schools? If the PE teachers are enthusiastic, generally, I'm not saying every PE teacher will be, but let's just, you know, assuming PE teachers are enthusiastic, is it a matter of funding? Is it a matter of a proper, widely accepted curriculum? Or is there something else that's maybe holding it back from disc golf taking root a little more in schools?
Well, we already have a well-established standards-based curriculum that's very impressive, and that's the Edge curriculum, which the Edge folks clearly spent a lot of time on. That is a great curriculum. I think that challenge, Steve, is taking it to the next level, going from a PE activity to a club type sport or a club sport level in secondary schools. That's a big challenge.
Okay.
A lot of folks like to talk about how disc golf should be a varsity sport in high schools, or it should be an NCAA sport and all that. And, you know, we're a long ways from that.
Very much, yeah.
But the challenge is taking it to the next level. And some of that comes along with, you know, you can teach kids, you know, say kindergarten through eighth grade, you can teach those kids some disc golf, basic fundamental disc golf skills, and hook them up with, you know, a disc or two, and, you know, use portable targets and do a nice disc golf unit. And some of those kids are going to love it and catch fire and become avid players someday. But to bring it to the next level and to make it a club level sport in secondary schools requires a course.
Oh yeah.
And so, or two, you know, or however many in the area. And there are some places, you know, that are set up for that. Disc golf hotbeds are already kind of set up for that, but other places certainly aren't. And, you know, having a course at your school is ideal. So, you know, we're working on that. We're working on some of that next level stuff. So,
okay. Now, I mean, I guess that kind of that parlays into my next question. You know, I feel like we've been at this crossroads before in disc golf, where there is kind of this, everyone thinks that the next level is coming soon. But we've been there for a while, and we haven't gotten to that point yet. And so I'm kind of wondering, you know, we're talking here about education and wanting to get disc golf into schools, which I've always been a huge proponent of. But there's also this growing professional scene that has more media on it and has, you know, the top level of the sport. So, I mean, how do you feel like the PDGA balances that, or and how much the board takes into consideration when balancing, you know, this growing professional side versus the fact that the vast majority of the PDGA's membership are amateur players? You know, where's that line for you as the board president in terms of where to really devote the resources?
Right. Well, remember my my kind of pyramid analogy.
Sure.
Well, you know, if you can really grow the top of the pyramid a little bit also, or highlight, I should say, the top of the pyramid, then you can also grow the pyramid, because, you know, the pro game is kind of our front porch. You know, folks can be exposed to disc golf in that way too, especially older adults, through professional disc golf tournament videos, or by going to a tournament and checking it out. And so, you know, that's important too. At the PDGA, our focus has always been, and I think probably should be still, on competition. In fact, in preparation for our spring summit, I took a look at our strategic plan, and I dumped it into Wordle. Are you familiar with Wordle?
I am not personally.
Oh, it's great. What you do is you use an HTML file or just a cut and paste, and you dump it into this program, and what it does is it creates a word cloud.
Oh, okay.
And so the words that appear more in the document are printed bigger, or are shown bigger in the word cloud.
Right, right.
And so I did that to get like a visual look at our strategic plan, just a quick visual look to see, okay, which words are repeated the most in the strategic plan, how important. It's really fun. It's fun to do. You know, history professors will take, you know, Lincoln's inaugural address and dump it into Wordle, versus Obama's inaugural address and dump it into Wordle and compare the two, and it kind of looks cool. But anyway, so would you like to guess, Steve Hill, which word was the biggest?
Well, I mean, you mentioned competition, so I'm going to guess either competition or tournament.
Yeah, competition.
Okay.
I mean, that is largely what we do, and competition, I think, now means more than just focusing all our time and energy on, you know, the national tour and majors and worlds, but other forms of competition that aren't as, you know, aren't super serious, or, you know, serious, but maybe not as intense, like leagues. I think leagues have taken off.
Yeah.
You know, 6 week long singles leagues. I mean, they're really inexpensive, and again, you know, a couple hours a week for 6 weeks, and you're immersed in a little bit of a competitive scene. And so for people who want just a taste of competition, but aren't necessarily going to compete in a national tour event, I mean, just look at the calendar. Look at the tournament calendar.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're setting records in terms of numbers of events. It just continues to grow.
It's mind-blowing. I mean, I remember looking in the back of the magazine to see where the tournaments were.
You know, need a whole magazine for
pages.
That now, at least.
Well, it was 2 pages front and back. Now, forget it. I mean, they printed in the magazine, which I think is cool. It's kind of retro cool. They got to use, like, you know, I don't know how big that font is, but I need like a magnifying glass to read the thing now. And so, you know, there's just a lot more. There's a lot more C tiers. There's a lot more leagues. You know, there's a lot more. They're competitive, but they're, you know, mellow.
They're not for the hardcore competitors. Yeah. They're for the people who want to dip their toes in a competition and see if they're ready for the, you know, the B tier, the A tier. Yeah.
Get a rating, and, you know, I think those things are definitely important to us. So we're working hard on those too.
Okay. Now I did put your, you know, put out that you were going to be coming on this show this week to a couple of different internet forums. And so I want to bring in a couple questions from there. And this one,
oh,
kind
boy.
Of, they were pretty gentle. This first one is kind of on the same subject of the professional tours and everything like that. So this one of these users asks, for majors, NTs, and the like, do you see the PDGA and tours looking at the course layout and structure as something that needs to be taken into account as the sport is growing? There's a little more of this question, so I'll get into that. It says, for example, more wooded courses are going to be difficult to allow spectators to safely watch from along the fairways. On the other hand, courses like Fountain Hills at the Memorial are more conducive to spectating, but have other issues like roads coming in and everything like that. So this person kind of concludes the question by asking, do you see courses like last year's Aussie Open or the Disc Golf Pro Tour Championship, which was on a ball golf course essentially, being sort of the template going forward? This person thinks that that's a little boring and is curious for your thoughts on, the mechanism of how courses are coming along on the professional scene and how we balance spectatorship with that. It's a tough question, I know.
Yeah. Well, if I heard it right, I think I agree with this person. It's kind of a catch 22, right? You know, the wide open courses on traditional golf courses or in public parks that are closed off but are, wide open. Those are easy. It's easy to manage the spectators there, and it's easy to get a lot of people in there. I'm partial to playing in the woods, and I'm actually partial to watching disc golf in the woods too. But it's harder to navigate your way as a spectator. Sometimes when we get deep in the woods, they have issues with cell phone reception or whatever that impacts the video and things like that. So that's an issue. I believe that partially wooded courses are always my favorite.
Okay.
A mix, because variety is it, I think, when it comes to even traditional golf courses, right? You're not going to play a traditional golf course and they're all dogleg lefts. It just doesn't work that way. You want elevation and you want some variety. So you want some open holes, some partially wooded holes, and some tightly wooded holes. So in terms of which courses are best, I agree that finding a course that has variety to it is optimal to watch the video or to watch in person and to play and to manage the spectators, for sure. We're on it in terms of reviewing courses and things of that nature. I mean, Sean Sinclair, as you know, was on the board, and he actually stepped down to take a contracted position with the PDGA,
right,
to get out there and do some of these things where he evaluates different courses and comes up with some suggestions and things of that nature. Of course, we had Mike Downs doing a lot of that, but we were working him to death. I mean, I was afraid we were just going to burn him right out. So he needed some help in that regard. And from what I've been told, Sean's doing a great job. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. I mean, if Sean's got a ton of experience with that, too.
Yeah.
He's played forever and seen 1,000 courses. So, I think that's great that he's on board helping with that. And, it's the tough balance of where the sport is at right now. It's one of those things where we kind of grew up throwing through the trees and everything like that. But if we want people to see it, it's hard to see through the trees sometimes.
Yeah.
So good challenges to have, though, I think, as we get bigger. All right. A couple more questions from the various forums here. This question, the first part of the question is maybe a little broad, but I'll just get into the whole thing. It says, what is the PDGA doing to help grow the game? What progressive efforts are our membership dollars contributing toward? And then finally, how much of this growth should be driven by local clubs rather than just solely the PDGA? So a couple-part question there.
This kind of relates to the questions that people are like, how are you spending my money? Kind of
right,
thing,
right.
Which is a worthy question for sure. And I'd like to remind folks that please go to pdga.com and check out our website and then go and look at the financials. Because
yeah, they are always there.
They're always there, man.
They're always updated
book.
There. Yep.
You know, we are an open book in terms of how we spend our nonprofit dollars. And we spend a lot of money on technology. Lots of money. And not all of it on payroll, but we spend a lot of money on technology. And it is well worth it. And we're lucky enough that we have two of the best guys in the business in terms of technology, and Steve Gantz and Peter Crist. I mean, they're just phenomenal people, and both of them are very, very bright and very hard workers. And so, you know, they have project after project after project related to technology. And you say, well, how does that really grow the sport? And although it may not be a like grassrootsy kind of thing, our goal is to really help out the tournament directors and the players. So if you want to play, in fact, I dare say, if you want to play in a tournament right now, or run a tournament as a TD, it is so much easier to do. It's so much easier to do than it was even 2 years ago. So we're trying to grow the competitive side of the sport by really upping our game in terms of our technology. And in terms of growing the sport in innovative ways at the grassroots level, I want to direct people to our website and say, please, please, if you have a cool idea, we have doubled the amount of the innovation grant. We are giving at least 10 innovation grants, awarding at least 10 innovation grants a year, two different times during the year. And you can get up to $1,000 for your exciting, innovative project that helps grow the sport at the grassroots level. And although these innovation grants, although they're certainly getting more competitive, I really welcome folks to take advantage of that. They're open to PDGA members and non-members, but they, you know, there tends to be PDGA members that submit those. I just encourage all of our members to do that, to submit an innovation grant. And then, of course, we spend, redirect our revenue to programs like the Educational Disc Golf Experience that bring disc golf into schools and teach PE teachers and other folks, rec park directors, people who have, you know, influence. We do all we can to turn them on to our great game of disc golf. So our revenue is well spent.
Yeah, and actually, if there is a really good resource on the PDGA website, if you go to the membership area, there's a frequently asked questions, and there's literally an article called "Where Do My Membership Fees Go?" Mm-hmm. So you can always look there, and then as well as if you go to pdga.com/pdga-documents, you can look at the strategic plan that Justin mentioned. You can also look at the budgets and everything like that. So, like you said, open book, nothing to hide there in terms of where it comes to the organization. All right, a couple more questions, and this one is kind of in the same vein in terms of transparency. This person asked the question, says, over the past year or so, there have been a couple incidences of policies being released that required an immediate about-face on the part of the organization. This person's referring to the tobacco policy, the policies on AMs taking merch, things like that. In at least one of these cases, the policy released didn't resemble a policy actually presented to the board. So the final question here is, what steps are being taken to prevent things like this from happening again? And is there a chance the oversight director position might be brought back?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's one I've faced before. Basically, what we have is we have three groups of people. We have the board of directors, we have the competition committee, and we have the rules committee. And those are three largely independent groups. which I think is a good idea. I like it when the rules committee and the competition committee don't necessarily agree. And believe me, they don't. I mean, these are these are three different groups with three different, you know, kind of personalities to the groups. And so I, as somebody who I appreciate them being independent. But if you're going to strive for independence, then you then have to strive for excellent communication between the three groups.
Of course.
And in addition to that, if there is a rule change or a policy change or something, we like to seek the staff input as well. And in addition to that, we like to reach out to a separate group of you know, vetted folks, like, for example, the state coordinators. Well, this has not always happened. It hasn't happened recently in terms of our communication. I don't think has been quite as effective as it could be. I pointed out to somebody one time that, you know, Brian Graham, he would have caught this stuff on before it went out the door. But it is entirely unfair to blame Joe Chargaloff, who's basically the oversight in this, who was, you know, on the job for like a day when yeah. all this stuff. I mean, he had just gotten on the job. And I mentioned that to somebody online, and they said, well, it sounds like you're making an excuse. And I'm like, well, you know, we could use your help anytime. It's like, so, yeah, I don't foresee much of this ever happening again in terms of something coming out and then having to retract. But the board of directors said, you know what? We're gonna step it back. You know, we're gonna walk this back. Okay, it's out there, and now everybody's gonna, you know, everyone might say, oh, look at these guys. They don't know what the hell they're doing. They release something and then they have to retract it. Well, you know, our attitude was, we're gonna get it right.
Right, right.
We're gonna get it right. It's like a, you know, a missed call in a basketball game or a football game. You know, they go to the video and they said, oops, you know, we made that call and it turned out not to be the right call. Sorry, spectators, you know, it's going to be another 3 minutes while we look at this, but but we're going to get it right. And that's how we viewed it. And I'm sure there's naysayers who say, well, that's not a very good example, Manichelli. It was almost like the game was over and then you changed your call. But I think we fixed the issues there. The issue was a communication issue. There's a lot of moving parts when it comes to rule changes and policy changes. And I think we got it right in the end. So, you know, all is not lost. I think next time we'll, next time there'll be better communication. And this is a new agey problem.
Sure,
I mean, if you wait, you used to have to wait to get the magazine to figure out what was going on in the PDGA. Now, you know, we can have an article posted to the website, you know, the next day or that evening. And so, you know, the other thing we got to do is make sure that we get it right before we, you know, release it to the world. Because in this day and age, as you know, Steve Hill, once it's out there, man, it's out there. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's the beauty of technology, but also the cautionary tales of it as well.
Yeah. So
no, and I appreciate your candor on that. I think just as long as I think people just want to hear that, number one, you guys are aiming to get it right, and number two, that you're working to fix the communication. I mean, and there's new board members. You guys are going to work on and new people on committees. It's going to take some time to kind of gel everything. And that kind of leads to my last question before the lightning round. You know, with the composition of the board as it stands right now, how does everyone mix? I mean, you talked about how the rules committee and the competition committee don't always agree. What's the, you know, I'm not asking you to air crazy stuff.
Oh, I'll go around and tell you. How's that? I'll tell you what I think of every person on the
board. There we go. I mean, how's it mix? How's it work together? What's the general vibe like right now with the board in general?
The vibe is fantastic. Really. It's great. I mean, we've got Bob Decker, who's been around forever.
Yep.
And brings a really unique skill set. He's still a hardworking tax man, you know. And so when it comes to, you know, IRS audits and, you know, things of that nature, boy, he's on it. And then, of course, Dave West. I don't know if you know Dave West, probably the nicest guy you'll ever meet in your life. Brings a real historical perspective and a real sense of calm and reason. Three-digit PDGA number, Dave West. Great guy. Great, great guy. And then we got Elaine King. I don't know if you knew, Elaine King has a PhD in analytical chemistry.
Oh, yeah. We actually talked about Elaine King a little bit earlier on the show and how amazingly smart she is.
Super bright and just, again, very, very reasonable and really. And then, you know, and then we've got Kevin McCoy, who's he has really interesting and innovative ideas and brings a lot of passion. And, of course, years of experience to the board, right?
I mean, for sure,
over 200 career wins. I mean, he's the player on the board for sure. And then we've got new folks like Nate Heinold, who's pretty young. He's very passionate and energetic and intelligent and hardworking. And of course, he brings a real TD perspective,
and marketing as well.
TD, yeah, and marketing, and he's been great. And then Dave Foss is another new person who is again a hardworking week in, week out TD, like running the club up there in Virginia, and just he's been just absolutely A+ fantastic as a new board member. I mean, great ideas. Very intelligent, just super hardworking. I mean, this has been the hardest working board that I've ever seen, and I think that maybe Brian Graham and Stork Roddick have ever seen. I mean, just tirelessly working for no compensation. May I remind folks, we are not compensated.
Right, right.
And just hardworking, man. And so, you know, when we make mistakes, you know, we apologize, but what we're going to do to fix those mistakes is we're just going to work even harder and dedicate even more time. So, you know, the board, we don't always get along, which, in terms of, we don't always agree, I should say.
Sure.
We don't always agree, which I think is great. But we are always very, very professional and very respectful of each other. And it's just a fantastic board, I think.
Are there any, I don't know, are there any initiatives that you guys are working on right now that you might want listener or member feedback on while you have this arena to seek it?
Yeah, and you know, I will know more for sure after our Spring Summit, because the Spring Summit is going to be a time for us to really again, look at our strategic plan and see where it is we're going and talk about the short-term future, because our strategic plan only goes up to 2020.
2020, right? Yeah.
So I would implore our members to check out, I think it's an abridged version of our strategic plan that is available to the members, although I may be incorrect, or maybe the abridged one's like real easy to find and then you got to dig for the longer version. But anyway, I would implore members to check that out. And then if there's something that you say, oh, I would like you guys to really emphasize this more or this less, or hey, why is this not part of our vision, then I would like you to shoot me an email, and I try to answer emails as quickly as I can. And as president, I discovered I get a whole lot more of them than I did when I was just on the board. So,
I believe it. I believe it. You are the go-to, I'm sure.
Right. So we've, you know, as you know, we've just rolled out some things, and so we're going to pump the brakes a little bit and in this at the spring summit and just take a look at where we're heading in the future. And so we always welcome member feedback. I mean, we are a member run organization, a member driven organization. So we always want to hear from our members, always.
Well, I will be sure. I'll be sure to link the strategic plan in the description here for the podcast this week, and we'll have to have you back on the show after the summit, I think, and kind of discuss how everything went there. Which means I'm gonna have to come up with some more lightning round questions because I can't let you go without doing the lightning round. It's what everyone has to do when they come on PDGA Radio. So, are you ready for the last quick 10 questions? Just first thing that comes to your head, give me the answer. All right.
Okay.
All right. Favorite course you've ever played?
Favorite course I've ever played? I've already stumped on the first question. I'll give it a three-way tie between Hornets Nest, Dan McDaniel's Hornets Nest, and you're going to see a crazy North Carolina bias here.
Well, that's okay.
Hornets Nest, which is, you know, a stand course, Jackson Park. People might not know about a Jay McCarthy design course in Henderson, North Carolina. That's fairly new. And my hidden gem is Ashe County Park in West Jefferson, North Carolina, designed by Harold Duvall. It's the course that everybody's heard about. It's, you know, a disc golf course review, but nobody's played. You know, everybody claims they played it, just like everyone claims they went to the first Lollapalooza, but really they didn't. Anyway, check those out for sure. Those are tied, three-way tie. How's that?
All right. Would you, now this is a question that I forgot to ask from one of the internet questions. Is North Carolina your favorite disc golf state then?
Yeah, I have a little bias there. North Carolina.
All right. Give me your best state besides North Carolina then.
Well, it's hard to beat Iowa.
Okay. Right? Iowa was on there.
I mean, most per capita.
There you
home
go.
Home of some great golfers. So yeah, I'll give Iowa a shout too.
All right, sounds good. Most difficult course you've played?
Most difficult course I've played is probably, well, Ashe County Park from the Longs is pretty hard, but the one at the IDGC, Warner. Which I don't really care for Warner as much. It just doesn't suit my game, and for me that's been the most of it. Shouldn't be.
Sure, sure.
It shouldn't be. I get it. It shouldn't be. For me it was, but.
All right, we'll put those ones on there. This is another internet question, so I decided to throw it on here. What's your favorite kind of salad?
Caesar.
Okay, there we go. Do you have a favorite professional disc golfer?
I have two favorite professional disc golfers, Jay Redding and Des Redding.
There you go. Those are pretty good ones right there.
Great people and good friends.
Oh, of course. What's your favorite sport to either play or watch besides disc golf?
I do like to ride mountain bikes. Really.
Oh, okay. Very nice.
Yeah, I prefer mountain bikes over just about anything else.
Well, this goes nicely with that. It has to do with wheeled vehicles. What was your dream car when you were a kid?
My dream car when I was a kid was a Corvette Stingray.
Nice. Very nice.
Or maybe a Porsche 911. One of those.
All right. Very cool. I'll take either of those. What would you be doing if you weren't a college professor?
What would I be doing? I would be a journalist.
Okay. Oh, all right. Good. I got some competition. I like that. who's one person, living or dead, you'd want to have dinner with?
I got to agree with Valerie Jenkins on this. Bob Marley.
Okay. Very nice. That'd be a good one. What was the last book you read?
The last book I read was Bruce Springsteen's biography.
Oh, okay. How was that? Now,
It was great. You know, he's my favorite of the sober guys. So I dig on Bruce Springsteen. So it was great.
All right. So if you're stuck on a desert island and you only get one album to listen to ever again, what's it going to be?
Oh, jeez.
I know. That's a hard one. That's a hard one.
I don't know.
I'll allow three again if you need three.
Grateful Dead, Europe 72, Bob Marley, Live from the Hollywood Bowl, 1976, and, you know, maybe something from the Allman Brothers, Live in late 70s, maybe Grateful Dead, Cornell 77, if you want me to take the obvious.
You got a lot of live stuff. I like it.
Yeah. I'm going to listen to some live music if I'm on a desert island because, you know, I want to feel like I'm there kind of
there
thing.
You go.
So,
there you go.
Yeah.
All right. And then the last one, cats or dogs?
Dogs. I'm going with dogs. Yeah.
Do you have dogs yourself?
I have neither. I have three kids. So that's enough.
Well, Justin, I appreciate you coming on. Again, this was Justin Menichelli, PDGA board president, co-author of The Definitive Guide to Disc Golf. If you have any feedback, you can reach him at jmenichelli@pdga.com. And hopefully we'll have you back on PDGA Radio soon, Justin. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks again to PDGA Board of Directors President Justin Menichelli for coming on and taking some time out to answer some, you know, disc golfers' questions. That's great. We're going to step into our time machine like we like to do every week for this week in disc golf history. We are going to go back not too terribly far. This one is going to be to 2010. This week in 2010 was the Sunshine State Shootout. It was a national tour event in Ocala. Am I saying that right? Is it Ocala, Florida?
I'm not the best person to... I mean, Florida's not really the South.
Sure it is. It's like Southern, anyway.
Geographically speaking, but
right.
Culturally not. Anyway.
Maybe not culturally. Anyway, I'm pretty sure it's Ocala. If it's not, someone please chime in and let us know if we are botching this. But it was in Ocala, Florida in 2010, the last time there was an NT in Florida. We haven't had an NT in Florida since. And the reason this one popped out to me is I was kind of going through some of the records and everything, and this is the only time they had this event as an NT. It's been there a couple more times, but just at a different tier and everything. So I kind of went and dug a little bit, and it was kind of cool. And I'm going to go ahead and link this article in with the show description this week on PDGA.com. So if you want to go back and read this yourself for a little bit more, you can. But there's an article about just the National Tour returning to Florida. And the whole idea was this was back in 2010. The recession had kind of hit a little bit, and you know, people were looking to disc golf to kind of hopefully bring people into their towns and everything. And that was kind of the whole idea with this event. So interesting to just kind of take a little bit of a walk down memory lane looking at this one-time NT out in Florida. As for the action, if it's an NT in Florida, shocking, Ken Climo won. You know, when you think Florida, you think Ken Climo, right? And so he actually ended up with a 1085 rated final round. And it looks like that and that forced him to... No, maybe not. It didn't force him to a playoff. The totals are the same, so it must have ended in a playoff. But it was between him and Nate Doss. Anyway, Ken Climo won it in the open side. Valerie Jenkins in the open women's. And then Phil Arthur won the Masters division. So pretty much a who's who of disc golfers at this event. And great, you know, not too long ago. But the cool part was this kind of got me down the rabbit hole of looking to see other NTs since then, because I don't remember all of them. You know, we get more and more of them, and especially with the Pro Tour and other events coming up, it's like we have a lot of high-end events now. So it jogged my memory that we had like King of the Lake up in the Tahoe area in 2011. There's been some really cool NTs. Also, it made me realize how far we've come in terms of scheduling. The 2010 National Tour, it went like the Memorial out in Arizona, and then 3 weeks later, Florida. And then it came back west again and then went back east. It was more of a series of spread out events than a tour like it is now. So just cool to see the evolution of where we've been going, and actually making a tour that people can be out on is pretty neat.
For sure.
Yeah. So Sarah, we are about to wrap up our show. What are we going to get to next week?
Speaking of big, exciting events, next week we are going to do a preview of Disc Golf Pro Tour's third event this year, Jonesboro Open. And we are also going to preview the 2018 Amateur World Doubles Championships in Mount Vernon, Texas. So looking forward to seeing what's going on with those.
Yeah, we got a good show next week. Jonesboro is always fun. I was going back to look at some of the video for Am Worlds. That was last year, and the venue there out in Texas, I believe it's at Sella Ranch again this year. Holy goodness, that place is just stunning. So excited to cover that stuff next week. Until then, I'm Steve Hill. That was Sarah Lamberson. We appreciate you listening to PGA Radio. Again, if you're enjoying the show, hate the show, want us to add something new to it, want to ask us a question, whatever, hit us up, radio@pdga.com. Feel free to subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. And until next week, be sure to throw well. We'll see you later.